Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. People stopping, staring. I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast wind, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Wah, 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 wah. My clothes, banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Everybody's talking at me, can't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. I won't let you leave my love behind. No, I won't let you leave.
Dustin Hoffman, I'm walking here. That was Harry Nilsson from Everybody's Talking from Midnight Cowboy. This is Hank Jones. You are listening to Hank Jones Polysports on Wednesday, August 4th, 2021. 4 weeks from today, me and Mrs. Jones head to Seattle, and then 30 days from today, our daughter gets married. So we are very excited. We are thrilled, actually. Anyway, you are listening to Hank Jones Polysports on Global Patriot Radio here on blogtalkradio.com every Wednesday at 5:30, like it or not. Other shows, Mondays, Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al. Tuesdays, Eric with Radio Free Kafiristan. Those both go at 6 o'clock, and then Thursdays at 6 o'clock, all Eastern time, the deplorable Paul Sutliff with the Sutliffian Report. And then Fridays at noon, I think, maybe 11 a.m., Conservative Casual Friday with Andrew Herod. Saturday nights, 10 p.m. till midnight, Minister Usama Dakduk and the beautiful Christie with Revealing the Truth About Islam, and reveal it they do. Sundays, Eric is back with Real Interfaith Dialogue, as has been mentioned before, and as will no doubt be mentioned again. You need to actually load the app and get permission. You can't just go in because some people have gone in and been real scumbags, and that's not cool. Like worse than that guy last week that got nasty at the end of his call? Yeah, worse than that. We're talking really bad stuff. Mrs. Hank is also here, as is our little Aussie. Cutest little dog ever. No two ways about it. Several ways to interact with the show. You, of course, can come online, blogtalkradio.com, hit the live button, find Global Patriot Radio, and you'll see us there. It tells you that we're here chatting. You can chat. Yes, you can. Or you can call 319-527-6706. You can listen that way. You can also talk that way. If you just hit the one on your phone, I get the little icon that says someone wants to talk. Just don't be like Hunter from last week and ask me a nasty question. But you can listen that way too. You can always email me, hjpsports1980@gmail.com. I am on Facebook. Just look for Hank Jones Polysports, or I'm on Twitter at HPolysports. Twitter is where I put out the daily, each day of the show when I'm on every Wednesday. You'll go there and it gives you a direct link if you want to just follow that link. It's real easy that way. I've never actually done it, but Vito told me that's the best way to do it. We got some listeners in right now. We've got someone in the chat room as well. Had two, but one had to leave, evidently. Going to have a couple of them on later. We're going to talk about some college football. But first, let us, of course, get to our obituaries for the week. Last Thursday, former Democrat senator from Michigan, Carl Levin, died at the age of 87. He had announced back in February that he had lung cancer. He was the chairman of the Senate Armed Forces Committee from 2001 to 2003 and again from 2007 to 2015. He's one you could consider as one of the leaders of the much failed policies at points in Afghanistan and Iraq due to this. So he thought he was obstructionist. He didn't want to do it. He voted to go into Afghanistan, but when it regard to Iraq, he said all along, we need to have a coalition, blah, blah, blah. And he fought everything. He criticized everything, not while Obama was in office, but with George Bush. And then, later with President Trump, he was critical, although he was out of office by then, I believe. Anyway, he was 87. That same day, Dick Lamb, former Colorado Governor Dick Lamb, passed away at age 85, just a week short of his 86th birthday, from a pulmonary embolism. Also on that day, not a good day for obituaries in one sense, the 29th, Thursday, rapper Gonzo was shot. He was with a group called Caution. He was shot and killed at the age of 45 in Seattle. If you want to look at the bright side, at least it doesn't go in Chicago's statistics too soon. Probably doesn't even go in Seattle statistics except as complications from COVID. That's probably how they're listing it. Last Saturday, Canadian sprinter Angela Bailey passed away at age 59. Ironically, that was on my 59th birthday. She passed away from cancer. She was Canada's national record holder in the women's 100 meters. She's also part of their silver medal winning 4x100 relay team at the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. Kyle DeFreitag, he was a former Capitol Hill police officer. He passed away July 10th, as announced by his mother. He was one of the Capitol Hill police officers that responded to the January 6th incursion at the U.S. Capitol. He was on the later shift. Anyway, he apparently took his own life, and according to reports, that he is the fourth Capitol Hill police officer to commit suicide. And then yesterday, the wrestling world lost former WCW and WWE wrestler and promoter Jody Hamilton at age 82 while he was in hospice care. Wrestling fans probably know him better by his ring name, The Assassin, or when he was with a tag team called The Assassins, he was Assassin Number One. And he literally was Assassin Number One from the founding in 1961. Until the team was no longer, but he was the only permanent member of the team. After that ended, he wrestled again as the Assassin, and he also wrestled as the Flame. He toured several territories, including one that he founded called Deep South Wrestling. He also worked at the Power Plant, which was WCW's training facility. Welcome Vito to the chat room, as well as Andy Hawk. So yeah, Jody Hamilton dead at the age of 82. Now in sports news, it's official. I'm going to bring in a couple of later on this to talk about this, but it's official. Texas and Oklahoma are joining the SEC effective 2025 when their current grant of rights with the Big 12 expires. And I don't even know where to begin on this. Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlesby has gone off. He says there was tampering. He's also in talks with the Pac-12. Big Ten seems to be laying low and staying quiet, although rumor mongers are saying Ohio State and Michigan are next. FSU and Clemson are also supposedly in the crosshairs. although FSU President John Thrasher says that is outright false and that zero discussions have taken place. Yeah, basically the talk or the fear or the dream, depending on how you talk about it, is that we're going to have one or two huge super conferences. One might, you know, one of you, some might laugh at this normally until one learns this one. The NCAA is having a, quote, constitutional convention in November. Yeah, at which point, of course, supposed insiders say that the Power Five or the SEC or Division One or whoever will either split from the NCAA or blow up the NCAA or take over the NCAA or maybe fold itself into Congress. I don't know. Seriously, that's how much credible info is out. We're going to talk about that a little later. I'll give them the time to call in. We're going to have Hawkeye Mike and Indie Hawk KB talking about it. Let's go to a political story. Why not? Let's just skip. I like skipping today. We're going to skip. So let's go to a political story. A friend posted this article on Facebook from theblaze.com. That's Glenn Beck's TV network and his network Steve Dace is on, amongst others. Authored by a guy named John W. Whitehead. And I am compelled to read this for you now. The article is beautiful. It's brilliant. It is so on point. It says what many of us think and feel, but it also kind of encapsulates that the First Amendment wasn't written to protect the majority or the popular or the cultural elite, but it was really to protect the free speech of all people, whether popular or not, politically correct or not, or even factual or not. So I bring you this from John W. Whitehead. And again, this is one of those articles where it's much better for me to read it to you because I'm just not going to be able to encapsulate it well enough. So here's what he says. How do you change the way people think? You start by changing the words they use. In totalitarian regimes, aka police states, where conformity and compliance are enforced at the end of a loaded gun, the government dictates what words can and cannot be used. In countries where the police state hides behind a benevolent mask and disguises itself as tolerance, the citizens censor themselves, policing their words and thoughts to conform to the dictates of the mass mind. Even when the motives behind this rigidly calibrated reorientation of societal language appear well-intentioned, discouraging racism, condemning violence, denouncing discrimination and hatred, inevitably the end result is the same: intolerance, indoctrination, and infantilism. It's political correctness disguised as tolerance, civility, and love. But what it really amounts to is the chilling of free speech and the demonizing of viewpoints that run counter to the cultural elite. As a society, we've become fearfully polite, careful to avoid offense, and largely unwilling to be labeled intolerant, hateful, closed-minded, or any of the other toxic labels that carry a badge of shame today. The result is a nation where no one really says what they really think anymore, at least if it runs counter to the prevailing views. Intolerance is the new scarlet letter of our day, a badge to be worn in shame and humiliation, deserving of society's fear, loathing, and utter banishment from society. For those haters who dare to voice a different opinion, retribution is swift. They will be shamed, shouted down, silenced, censored, fired, cast out, and generally relegated to the dust heap of ignorant, mean-spirited bullies who are guilty of various word crimes. We have entered a new age where, as commentator Mark Stein notes, we have to tiptoe around on ever thinner eggshells. The forces of tolerance are intolerant of anything less than full-blown celebratory approval. In such a climate of intolerance, there can be no freedom of speech, expression, or thought. Yet, what the forces of political correctness fail to realize is that they owe a debt to the so-called haters who have kept the First Amendment robust. From swastika-wearing neo-Nazis marching through Skokie, Illinois, and underage cross-burners to, quote, God hates fags, unquote, protesters assembled near military funerals, those who have inadvertently done the most to preserve the right to freedom of speech for all have espoused views that were downright unpopular, if not hateful. Until recently, the U.S. Supreme Court has reiterated that the First Amendment prevents the government from proscribing speech or even expressive conduct because it disapproves of the ideas expressed. However, that long-vaunted, court-enforced tolerance for, quote, intolerant speech has now given way to a paradigm in which the government can discriminate freely against First Amendment activity that takes place within a government forum. Justifying such discrimination as, quote, unquote, government speech, the court ruled that the Texas Department of Motor Vehicles could refuse to issue specialty license plate designs featuring a Confederate battle flag. Why? Because it was deemed offensive. The court's ruling came on the heels of a shooting in which a 21-year-old white gunman killed 9 African Americans during a Wednesday night Bible study at a church in Charleston, South Carolina. The two events, coupled with the fact that gunman Dylan Roof was reportedly pictured on several social media sites with a Confederate flag, have resulted in an emotionally charged stampede to sanitize the nation's public places of anything that smacks of racism, starting with the Confederate flag and ballooning into a list that includes the removal of various Civil War monuments. These tactics are nothing new. This nation, birthed from puritanical roots, has always struggled to balance its love of liberty with its moralistic need to censor books, music, art, language, symbols, etc. Thanks to the rise of political correctness, the population of book burners, censors, judges, executioners has greatly expanded over the years so that they run the gamut from left-leaning to right-leaning and everything in between. By eliminating words, phrases, and symbols from public discourse, the powers that be are sowing hate, distrust, and paranoia and bottling up dissent, creating a pressure cooker of stifled misery that will eventually blow. The question, of course, is what's next on the list to be banned? It was for the sake of preserving individuality and independence that James Madison, the author of the Bill of Rights, fought for a First Amendment that protected the minority, even a minority of one, against the majority. This freedom for those in the unpopular minority constitutes the ultimate tolerance in a free society. Conversely, government-sanctioned intolerance always ends up the same, with an indoctrinated, infantilized citizenry that marches in lockstep with the governmental regime. Orwell understood the power of language to manipulate the masses. In 1984, Big Brother relies on newspeak to eliminate undesirable words, strip such words as remained of unorthodox meanings, and criminalize independent, non-government-approved thought. Where we stand now is at the juncture of old speak, where words have meanings and ideas can be dangerous, and new speak, where only that which is safe and accepted by the majority is permitted. As I document in my book, Battlefield America, The War on the American People, the power elite has made its intentions clear. It will pursue and prosecute any and all words, thoughts, and expression that challenge its authority. This is the final link in the police state chain. Having been reduced to a cowering citizenry, mute in the face of elected officials who refuse to represent us, helpless in the face of police brutality, powerless in the face of militarized tactics and technology that treat us like enemy combatants on a battlefield, and naked in the face of government surveillance that sees and hears all, we have nowhere left to go. Our backs are to the walls. From this point on, we have only two options: go down fighting, or capitulate and betray our loved ones, our friends, and ourselves by insisting that, as a brainwashed Winston Smith does at the end of Orwell's 1984, yes, 2 + 2 does equal 5. Absolutely brilliant. Absolutely encapsulates what is happening in our country. Totally, totally points up how anything that is deemed offensive to just one person becomes, in essence, not just unreasonable, unsayable, unthinkable. I mean, it's just that simple. It's we are submitting to a cultural elite, a power elite, that it's not enough for them to tell us to get vaccinated, you know, whatever, pay taxes, get a driver's license, not show an ID for certain things, whatever it is. We're supposed to submit to whatever it is that they deem appropriate. And it starts with speech. Won't end there, but it starts there. Things aren't looking good for Governor Cuomo in New York. He has been, the New York Attorney General has determined that he did harass and, I don't want to say molest, but he did harass and intimidate women, co-workers, subordinates, etc., including possible threat of termination. I don't know. I'm not shocked. I can tell you a lot of people have weighed in on it. The Epoch Times did. They basically say an impeachment investigation is as quickly as possible. New York State Assembly Speaker has said it. There are calls for him to resign. Letitia James, the state attorney general, for whatever reason, didn't actually file charges. I don't know why. But apparently Democrats in the New York Assembly met to discuss it. Several have said it's abundantly clear that he has lost the confidence of the Assembly Democratic majority and that he can no longer remain in office. They are talking about impeachment. Cuomo, for his part, is refusing to resign. Not only that, he's doubling down. He's saying he didn't do anything wrong and everyone else is wrong. He's right. But here's what it says. The Senate Majority Leader, a female named Andrea Stewart Cousins, she said, she didn't mention impeachment, but she said the investigation is complete and the allegations have been substantiated. I see. We're not talking about allegations. We're talking about substantiated. She said it should be clear to everyone that he can no longer serve as governor. Chuck Schumer, Kirsten Gillibrand have called on him to resign, even Biden supposedly. He accused the investigators of being biased. He asked New Yorkers to look at a report that he had produced by his lawyer that alleges the investigators ignored his testimony and substantial corroborating evidence. I want you to know directly from me that I never touched anyone inappropriately or made inappropriate sexual advances. I am 63 years old. I have lived my entire adult life in public view. That is just not who I am, and that's not who I have ever been, the governor said, as pictures of him hugging and kissing various officials were shown. Yeah. Here's a different take, though. Greg Kelly from Newsmax, he says it's a witch hunt. Not lying. Greg Kelly says it's a witch hunt. Now, his thing is he's not a fan. He said, look, he says, but I've been around long enough. I know what happens, and I can see a freaking witch hunt when it happens. And that's what's happening here. I don't know why, you know, again, I don't know where Greg Kelly's coming from, because we're talking about stuff that, again, substantiated. I guess where he's going with this is that he's saying unwanted groping and kissing, et cetera. He says, we gave Biden a pass. The press gave Biden a pass. The party put Biden in power. Kelly said, I'm not a fan, but he's no sexual predator. That's what he said. He said, we've all seen Joe Biden grab and smell and grope people for years. He pointed out that Letitia James' report is not a criminal referral, but just for people to read to the media. So, yeah, we'll see. And as Kelly pointed out, Letitia James also said she would get Donald Trump when she was running for attorney general. By the way, a Marist poll shows only 59% of New Yorkers want him to resign. Now, when I say only, like I said, I'm not sure what the hell to make of that. I'm really not. Greg Kelly makes a great point vis-a-vis Dopey Joe, not to mention how they circled the wagons for President Clinton. Remember that, folks? But like I said, meanwhile, according to Governor Cuomo, everybody's wrong. It never happened. Seriously, that's his response. I mentioned earlier, a fourth Capitol Hill police officer has committed suicide. Well, I mean, I guess if they want us to believe that, we'll pretend to for a while. I mean, seriously, what is going on here? Seriously, somebody talked about it. I posed the question on a Twitter retweet. I retweeted something, and I said, really, what's going on? And somebody made the comment, maybe he was bullied, with sort of a shrugging meme. Makes as much sense as anyway. So, though, really, it does beg the question, are these officers getting Arkansas-ed? Are they being pressured to lie, and they're just cracking under the pressure? Somebody on Capitol Hill not named Pelosi should maybe look into this. That's for sure. Now, let's go back to a quick sports. Okay. Last week's NBA draft saw two Iowa Hawkeyes, go in the second round. Guard forward Joe Wieskamp went to the San Antonio Spurs with the 41st pick, and center Luka Garza, the consensus player of the year, two-time All-American, went to the Detroit Pistons with the 52nd pick. He's going to join Luka Garza is going to rejoin Hawkeye teammate Tyler Cook in the Motor City, while Joe Wieskamp will get to hang out with Mr. Woke himself, San Antonio coach Greg Popovich. Let's hope Popovich, by the way, doesn't blow the Olympics first. Seriously. So, and also, the Iowa Board of Regents approved the naming of the field at Kinnick Stadium. It's official now. It will now be known as Duke Slater Field at Kinnick Stadium. And look, while some say this is long overdue, you have to remember Kinnick Stadium was a reaction to two things. One, Niall Kinnick was and still is Iowa's only Heisman Trophy winner. He was also that year the AP Athlete of the Year. He was a Phi Beta Kappa. He turned down the NFL, went to law school, then he volunteered for Navy service in World War II. And then, of course, the other thing, he gave his life in World War II. He died in a plane crash in the Caribbean's Gulf of Paria in 1943 when his plane had an oil leak. He had to do a water landing, and he was never recovered. But make no mistake, Duke Slater was a man among boys in the late 19-teens and early 1920s. His coach, Kinnick's coach at Iowa, was a gentleman named Dr. Eddie Anderson, who played at Notre Dame. He played against Duke Slater during Slater's career. And he said, along with others, talked about how Slater always required a double team and sometimes a triple team to try and neutralize his dominance on the line. But it didn't end there. Duke Slater went on to be a Cook County judge. He remained a steadfast Hawkeye supporter until his death in 1966 or 67. There is a dormitory named after him at Iowa called Slater Hall. Went to a couple of parties there, actually. But this is a long time coming. And frankly, if you ask me, 20 years from now, we should, like I said, we should be discussing calling it Kinnick Slater Field at Frye-Ferentz Stadium. But that's just me. That's my thing. If Hawkeye Mike and Indy Hawk KB want to call in, I think Hawkeye Mike is on the line. So if he's ready to hit the one, hit that one, and I will bring you guys on because we're going to talk a little bit of college football. Hawkeye Mike's on the line. He's ready to go. I don't know where Indy Hawk KB is. Mike, you there?
Yeah, how's it going, Hank?
Good. Yes, that party, Heidi's party.
I think it was the Heidi party.
It was Heidi's party, was at Slater. It indeed was. I was just thinking about that as I mentioned that. I'm not shocked somehow that we both remembered that for some reason. Let me bring in Indy Hawk as well.
Yeah, I forever have memories, flashbacks of the that party because of the big giant Wapatuli vat that they were using a yardstick to stir with.
Yeah, and all the paint was gone.
And all the paint was, yeah, it was just
yeah. And yet it didn't even taste like alcohol. It literally didn't taste like alcohol. It just, you can smell it. So, Andy, you there?
Yes, I'm here. How you doing, guys?
All right. Good. Good to hear both of your voices. Okay, so let's talk about this. Mike, you posed the question in our group text. Is the NCAA going to legislate itself out of existence?
Well, we can always hope, but I doubt that's going to happen. Too much vested interest.
In a nutshell, I think what Mark Emmert is doing, he's probably seeing his $3 million a year job going up in smoke. And as do the other NCAA honchos. Guess what, though? They have nobody to blame but themselves. So, yeah,
well,
go ahead,
can
Mike.
Can I ask, why do we need the NCAA anymore? I mean, can't the conferences just run college sports? That's probably a naive question, but it's something that's always kind of, you know, like, what does the NCAA do except kind of make dumb rules and frustrate schools and conferences from doing what they want to do?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, they have no subpoena authority. In other words, they can tell a school, we want this, and if school says no, they just don't. I mean, we saw how they botched the Miami-Florida investigation, you know, where they literally were compromised in that investigation by one of the investigators being taken out to dinner and drinks, et cetera, by some Miami people. I mean, that, you know, so that killed a lot of the credibility. But theoretically, the conferences, I mean, do you see the SEC policing themselves on recruiting violations?
No, but I wasn't saying that the conferences would necessarily do a better job or a good job of governing themselves. Just pointing out that, you know, I mean, is that why we need the NCAA to kind of try to keep the SEC from going crazy? Because if that's the case, I don't think it's working.
No, it's not. Andy, what are your thoughts? You think the NCAA's outlived its usefulness?
I don't know. It just makes me wonder, you know, if we're heading to one conference, two conferences, you know, three, four, where we end up, it's just going to dilute them more. So.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I heard an interesting thing today because people have talked about the ACC. They have huge penalties for exit. And that was a response to the Big Ten plucking Maryland. But their grant of rights is in force until 2036. And if you leave, that grant of rights money stays. In other words, if Florida State were to leave, that grant of rights money stays in the NCAA or in the ACC, no matter what conference Florida State's in. So,
is that with their TV contract?
Yeah. Well, and not just that. It's TV, radio, you know, even I think might even be merchandising. I'm not 100% sure on that because I know the Hawks have a lot of their own merchandising stuff. But so I don't see how that's I just don't see Clemson and Florida State making a jump. You know, I mean, I don't see what they, you know, with that kind of thing in play. But, you know, here's a couple ideas I have, and I want to hear your guys' take on it. Okay. First of all, I feel bad for Bob Bowlesby. I really do. But, you know, in some ways he's got his own, you know, he's to blame on his own. But for Oklahoma and Texas, it's really simple. It's about money, right? I mean, Big 12 simply doesn't command the media rights. I mean, what markets do they have? They've got, other than what's in Texas, they've got what, Tulsa, Kansas City, St. Louis, and then add West Virginia. I mean, so that's a huge problem. I feel bad for Iowa State. What do you guys think Iowa State does?
I think they are in a lot of trouble. It'd be interesting to see what Indy Hawk thinks, but, you know, I don't know what the solution is. They really don't bring anything to the Big Ten. I talked to Iowa State people, including my brothers, that they can just waltz into the Big Ten, but I think they're living in fantasy land if they think that's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Go ahead, Eddie.
The Big Ten is, it depends how you slice it. Like, you know, as a fan, I'd like to see, you know, Notre Dame, of course, and maybe USC, or I heard Mike in the morning, Mike Greenberg, he's saying, And he sees the Pac-10 joining with the Big Ten. I really hope the Big Ten doesn't do that. I mean, the Big Ten's kind of in the driver's seat. They're one of the top two with the SEC, but they actually yep. take in more money than the SEC. So great pass. So they can really pick their spots. I hope they're smart about it.
Yeah, I mean, here's what the SEC did. They, in addition to New Orleans, Atlanta, and Nashville, and all of Alabama and most of Florida, they basically picked up the Texas markets, you know, which is huge. I mean, Dallas, Houston, absolutely huge. Recruiting, it doesn't really matter because the big boys in those places are always going to be national recruiters, whether it's Ohio State in the Big Ten or whatever. But Big 12 has never gotten two teams in the college football playoff. They never had both teams of the BCS game, you know. I mean, like the SEC did, you know, in one of its last years. So yeah, I think a two loss Texas or Oklahoma, as an example, would theoretically, you know, under a 12 team playoff, they'd have a chance to get in. You know, a two loss Oklahoma in a 12 team playoff, yeah, they'd have every right to expect an invite, so to speak. So I think that's part of it. I mean, I think it's a no brainer why Texas and Oklahoma left. Like I said, I feel for Bowlesby as much as he's, you know, Hawkeye fans just didn't like him as our athletic director, most notably the Tom Davis retirement and the Pierre Pierce Alford situation. He got blindsided here, it looks like. And I think that's a crappy way to do a commissioner. I really do. But they say it's ruined friendships, that there are people that are not on speaking terms right now within those schools and conferences. So, you know, but here's the other thing. What do you guys think? It's a 2025 is the announced date. Do you really think that those schools are still going and the Big 12 is still going in 2024?
I think it's going to be hard to do. Go ahead, Andy Hawk. I think you probably agree with me on that.
They're going to invite a bunch of teams, smaller schools, but I mean, you look at what they've lost: Colorado, Nebraska, A&M, Missouri, now Texas and Oklahoma. I mean, it's not looking good. I mean, I think the Big 12 is, you know, I don't know. Maybe you guys know what constitutes a Power Five, and we're heading to the Power Four, but I don't think they stay as a Power Five. There's some rights.
I don't see how they do either without Oklahoma and Texas. I mean,
the Big East lost theirs. What when it got rated by the ACC? It wasn't really. I mean, that was sort of. I don't remember how that played out, because remember with was the Big East not considered a Power Five? I don't even remember that. I mean,
you know, that thing kind of evolved, and it's always been kind of, unofficial, unofficial. But, you know, clearly the Power Five, you know, before all this happened, was distinct in terms of their influence. I think what Indy Hawk's getting at as far as, like, you know, are we a power, is it going to be a power, effectively anyway, Power Four, Power Three? Well, we don't really know how this is all going to pan out yet, which is kind of my impulse is, like, the Big Ten should just stay cool and let these things develop. You know, at least that part of me is that way. The other part of me, though, is like the SEC is sort of like the modern-day Soviet Union. You know, they're eating everything up, or the way they used to be. And, you know, do we, is there some sort of domino effect here that the Big Ten's got to make sure that the SEC doesn't just become so – you know, what are they going to do? Are they looking, you know, you're talking about Florida State, Clemson. Do they want 18 teams, 20 teams, 24? Well, I mean, I don't know what the SEC is really up to at this point. And, you know, it kind of, so I don't, part of me is like the Big Ten should just hold pat, not do anything, see how this pans out. But the other, on the other hand, you know, you don't want to be, you know, while the SEC is vacuuming up all these schools they want, you know, and the Big Ten have to do something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, you know, you think of what Bowlesby's trying to do. He's meeting with the Pac-12. I don't think he's meeting with the AAC, which is UCF and Cincinnati, because it sounds like ESPN and the AAC were quote unquote in cahoots. Now, according to both ESPN and the AAC, they're saying no, but as many people have said, whether it's the guy, Mike and Mike, and or Mark Packer on ESPNU radio, they're all saying that, look, they have plausible deniability because whatever you're seeing now, whatever the, even the Big Ten, whatever they're doing, you can bet it's not being done via email. And it's probably not being done by, you know, I mean, Texas and Oklahoma supposedly, even the coachings, the coaches weren't in on it in the initial phase. I mean, you know, and with good reason, because, you know, it doesn't last long as a secret, supposedly. But, you know, so I see Bowlesby trying to jump out. You know, that's another thing, though. I think ESPN's a villain here. I think they are, you know, I watch it. I read the website, but I think these people are scumbags. And that was before all this. I mean, I think they're self-serving. Besides ratings and revenue, they've tried to manipulate, you know, conference ratings over the last several years. They have tried to, you know, manipulate, you know, even look at when a second tier, when a Big Ten game is on in their thing, they don't put it on ABC, rarely. They don't put it on even on their ESPN flagship. They put it on ESPNU or ESPN2, unless it's Ohio State or Penn State. But other than that, I think they're sleazy, you know, and I think their hands aren't clean in this. So,
well,
I mean, there's,
you know,
a reason.
The thing that kind of strikes me is that this thing didn't happen overnight. So it's pretty apparent that Oklahoma and Texas were in cahoots with each other, keeping the rest of the Big 12 schools in the dark while they were, you know, sort of, you know, fomenting their little schemes with the SEC. Now, I don't know, you know, was ESPN the middleman, the impetus, or was the SEC the ones that were seeking out Oklahoma and Texas, or Oklahoma and Texas seeking out the SEC? I'd like to know all that, because I think that's kind of that, you know, it's just very interesting to know what the machinations here are. Because obviously the Oklahoma and Texas, I mean, is everything just the dollar? There's no, I mean, they have a long tradition in the Big 12, particularly Oklahoma, with a lot of those schools. It's just the hell with those teams anymore. We don't care. They don't help us, and we get more money this way. That's all that matters. Is that where we're at in everything in this country, in everything in sports, college sports, which is until the NIL was amateur sports?
Yeah.
You know, I guess it's all, you know, I'm being naive. I think it's, you know, money's the only thing that matters.
Yeah,
well,
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty close, because, I mean, the football drives, I think, 75% of the programs at a university.
That's
four times bigger than men's basketball. But you know, you think about, okay, the Big Ten could look at, man, if you got North Carolina and Kansas to come aboard, that'd be a heck of a basketball conference, but they're kind of weak on football. But I saw some numbers, and football is about four times bigger than men's basketball as far as revenue, and then the other sports, it drops off dramatically. So you get these TV contracts. I think that's like 75% of the revenue, or some crazy number, 70 plus. It's a lot of money, and they can build up their facilities, offer scholarships. So it's definitely a factor for sure.
I mean, I've got a multi-part solution if I'm the Big 12, and I would get on the phone. Now, I wouldn't get on the phone just with the Pac-12. I'd get on the phone with the Big 10 too. If I'm Bob Bowlesby, I mean, he's got some connections. You know, here's what I do. First thing I'd do, I would tell Nebraska. I would ask. Release Nebraska and let them go to the Big 12. And then release West Virginia from the Big 12 and let them come to the Big 10. I just think that makes a lot more sense geographically, market-wise, et cetera. I think Nebraska and the Big 10 is just not a fit.
That takes an automatic win off the Hawks football schedule, though.
Yeah,
yeah, that's true. But
wouldn't West Virginia be a more natural fit for the ACC?
Yeah, but I don't think, you know, I don't think the ACC matches up with, I mean, geographically maybe, but not really. Think about it. They're closer to Maryland than they are really to North Carolina or South Carolina or Georgia, you know, with Georgia Tech. So I just, you know, other than you have Pitt and Syracuse in the ACC, but the ACC, I think the thing is, the ACC, I think, is off the table. I think they're granted rights until 2036, and you lose every dime if you leave. I think that, you know, because I don't think the big, you know, the SEC will pony up front money, I think, to a Texas or an Oklahoma to get out of the Big 12 if they could. There's no way they're going to pony up for like a Pitt or a Syracuse to leave, and no conference would. Why would you?
You know, but you know, to me, like Pitt and Syracuse would be a more natural addition for the Big Ten. You know, you'd renew the Pitt Penn State rivalry, which used to be a pretty big deal, and they're both pretty solid in basketball, and not bad football programs either. At least they've had some ups and downs, but I, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's so hard to predict what's going to happen. I think, you know, the everything's been kind of flux here, I think.
When it's interesting, when we look at fit, we look at, you know, what's a good matchup. You get these rivalries back together. What they look at, getting back to the money thing, is, you know, TV sets, markets. So the one Pac-12, Big Ten that I thought was okay, would be okay, is that USC, Stanford, UCLA, Washington, Oregon come to the Big Ten. And he was thinking Notre Dame could possibly join too, because Notre Dame wants to go out west for a game every year. But I don't. I figure Notre Dame's probably off the table. But having those top tier teams out of the Pac-12 would make it pretty strong.
Do you think that gets
the Big Ten in the West Coast. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, supposedly one of the Big Ten requirements is that the school has to be geographically connected. In other words, West Virginia is connected enough to, you know, with Ohio and Pennsylvania and sort of to Maryland, although it's not a direct border. But, you know, Nebraska borders Iowa, so that's why it was, a Big Ten fit. But supposedly there's no way the Big Ten is going to ever take in Pac-12 schools because there is no geographical connection. Yeah, that's a legend. Now, I don't know. You know, the next thing I would do, though, like I said, I would get the Big 12 to get Nebraska, if I'm Bob Bolsby, and then I would release West Virginia to the Big 10. Now, here's the problem. Historically, Nebraska has much more of a following. But West Virginia picks up a bit of that market on the East Coast, you know, so there's that. The other thing I would do, then I would just merge with the Pac-12, call it the Big Pac-20 or whatever. Don't kick out Texas and Oklahoma yet. Just don't schedule them with any Pac-12 members. You know what I mean? I mean, make it a condition of the merger or something. Force Texas and Oklahoma to either pay their exit fees or go to court or whatever. But make the move with the Pac-12, man, and leave Texas and Oklahoma out as much as possible. What's your thoughts on that? Am I crazy?
So many things can happen. It's just like, you know, I think what Indy Hawk just mentioned with some of the Pac-12 schools would be the premier Pac-12 schools, as he outlined, it's very attractive theoretically. I just don't know whether, you know, in reality, how much of a chance there is of doing something like that. But that would certainly be, and then that would, you know, and with Southern Cal's rivalry with Notre Dame, plus the money, they all combined there. That might tempt Notre Dame, actually into the Big Ten. But I always thought a problem Notre Dame had was they didn't want to be in the Big Ten. They could have been a long time ago because, A, the deals they get by being an independent, but also the Big Ten beats them up. They were playing Michigan, Michigan State, Purdue every year, and they were not necessarily coming out the better on that. They were getting beat a lot. And they know if they were in the Big Ten that they would be a tough slog every year for them. So I think that was part of the factor, too.
I just read a couple days ago that the Notre Dame TV package is less money than the Big Ten teams are getting, which shocked me.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and that's another factor, too. I was reading something. The Big Ten has a big negotiation coming up in 2023 for they're expecting a huge TV deal. So they may be thinking they don't want to rock the boat too much between now and then. But on the other hand, maybe it would be a good idea to bring it if they can bring in some of these marquee schools. It wouldn't hurt. And that's probably
where the SEC involvement would have come in. Would have been this. You know, look, you guys are coming up for a renegotiation in 20 whatever. Well, we'd like to see you get some other high profile because you know, from ESPN's standpoint, you're really talking about Florida, Georgia, Alabama, LSU. Occasionally Texas A&M, once in a great while, not no longer, but once in a great while, Tennessee. But really, they're still really only talking about four marquee schools that you can that they can count on. And, you know, so that's I would get that. And so they're probably in that part of that negotiation that, look, if you guys want us to continue to pony up, we need to see something a little better than Alabama Ole Miss. And frankly, you know, Alabama in there in week 11 playing College of Charleston or whatever, Charleston Southern. I mean, I think, you know, big ESPN doesn't care about, you know, cupcake wins, so to speak. They want – they you know, like Indy Hawk said, they don't care about asses in the seats. They care about asses in front of the TV. You know, that's what they're worried about. So that's why ESPN would be involved. I mean, you know, talk about the Pac-12. You see USC, you know, USC and Notre Dame, when they play, when USC plays at Notre Dame, they don't play in November. If that's a November game, that's Notre Dame on the coast. That's written into their contract. When USC plays at Notre Dame, it's a September or October game. You see USC going to Minnesota in November.
I don't think that's very attractive for them.
No,
I'll just point that out. Yeah. No, so, I guess the answer is no. I don't see it.
Yeah, exactly. Now Vito in the chat room has pointed out he pointed out two things. Geraldo did come to King Cuomo's aid and said he should not resign, but he asked what Texas brings to the SEC. I think he's right. I mean, you know, everybody's talking about Steve Cuddy Sarkisian, but really, what's he doing that Tom Herman didn't do, or that Mac Brown wasn't doing before, or Charlie Strong, or whatever? I mean, I don't see that. I don't see that being very attractive in terms of competitiveness. But like Indy said, they don't really care. They just care about eyes in front of the TV.
It seems
right.
like I've been
and
hearing
and
it.
They get the huge market. Yeah.
It seems like I've been hearing about Texas for 15 to 20 years. It's ripe for the taking. It's perfect location. Alumni, everything's there to build a, you know, a top-tier program all around, but it just doesn't come to pass.
Yeah, but then again, you don't get a Vince Young every year either, but...
Right.
So,
but, I mean,
know.
they've never taken that step to be elite, you know, consistently.
No, they haven't. You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, the other thing is, you know, we're talking about, what about the ACC, you know, and the AAC? I mean, do you even try, I mean, if they were in on that, and now they say they weren't, but I don't know why Bob Bowlesby would say that if he didn't, you know, have something, you know, a leg to stand on. But, you know, do you even trust those conferences now, you know? And frankly, if you're the Big 12, I don't know if there's any Big 12 SEC non-conference matchups coming up. You know, like if Missouri's playing anyone or –
I thought like there was Wisconsin that's playing like Georgia or somebody in the next year or two.
Yeah, but that's
but
I'm talking Big 12. I'm sorry, I meant Big 12 SEC.
Oh, Big 12. I'm sorry. I thought you said SEC.
No,
Big 10,
I may have
season.
Said Big 10. That's why I wanted to clarify, make sure. I mean,
okay.
You know, that's another thing I do is if I'm the Big 12, if I'm Bob Bowlesby, I strongly discourage teams from Big 12 teams from honoring those commitments. You know, maybe not. Maybe just hold off. But I mean, if he's going to if the conference is going to implode anyway, you know, why should they? I mean, I would be, you know, that date down in Alabama in September for Kansas, if that were happening, doesn't look very good anyway. So why do it? You know, I mean, it's not like the SEC hasn't backed out. Now it was when they were a part of the Big 12, but remember Missouri backed out of our series with Iowa in 2009 and 10 or 2006 and 7, whenever it was, they backed out of a home and home. So I don't think that's a bad thing to just back out of it. So
well,
who knows?
Let me ask you guys, this is, I think, you know, with the Big 12 without Oklahoma and Texas, is the best thing for them to do maybe to just try to bring in a couple, you know, they'd be lesser teams, maybe like a BYU or Cincinnati or somebody like that, and then just accept that they're kind of a little bit less than a Power Five conference, but they at least are a conference, and they still would be a pretty decent basketball conference. Because
what
the
I think they'll do.
To, Yeah, I think so too. Because they're in the land of they have no choice, right? Because what's the alternative if these schools try to go it alone? I think they're going to get laughed out of the boardrooms in the Big Ten and the SEC. They just don't want them. So maybe the best thing to do is just accept a little bit of a lesser stature, bring in a couple schools they can get, and then just, you know, that's the conference that they have.
That's pretty much what they did last time, you know, brought in some smaller schools and got back up to 10 or whatever their number is now.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's I mean, think of Texas Tech, though. I mean, what's Texas Tech thinking? You know, I can't imagine that their administration is happy with Texas right now. You know, not that Texas
cares.
They
could get like a Houston or somebody like that. Houston or would be a good addition, maybe.
Houston's in the AAC. You know, the AAC is kind of got a good thing going. I mean, their schools have done well in recent years. You're talking Cincinnati, UCF, Houston, Memphis, all of those have done reasonably well in New Year's Six bowls in the last, you know, 8 or 10 years. So they've got a, you know, they might have as good a bargaining chip as anyone. And frankly, if they came calling to the Big 12, I think the Big 12 should listen. You know, I really do. But only on the, right. on the basis that all of, you know, you can't leave any Big 12 members behind. I mean, the one I worry about, believe it or not, is Iowa State. I mean, I know a lot of Hawkeye fans would say, Cyclones, I don't laugh at that. I mean, I really worry about Iowa State, what could happen to them.
Well, and I think the Kansas schools are in a tough spot, too. But, you know, you could argue Kansas because their basketball program, but, you know, their football program is so bad. You know, and like you guys are pointing out, football is the name of the game, really. But Kansas State would seem to me to be as in as tough a spot as Iowa State. Texas Tech, same thing. You know,
I mean, Baylor, Tech and Baylor, though, have had recent Final Four. Baylor is the defending national champion in basketball. In basketball. Now, basketball's a little different in that, you know, conference affiliation, important as it is, isn't all be all end all. You know, where it maybe helps is getting extra team. You know, 18-10 teams from the Big Ten got a better chance to go than an 18-10 team from, you know, the American Athletic Conference or the Sun Belt or whatever. But you know, that's, you know, beyond that, it's not, you know, it's not crucial. I mean, a good team is going to get in, so. But yeah,
one thing we haven't talked about is the American Association of American Universities, with that being a Big Ten requirement.
Yep.
For academics, so there's only, I think, 60 teams or 60 schools in there, and I don't think Clemson's in there. But
is it? Do you think it's is it an anachronism really for the Big Ten to insist on AAU membership in this? You know, you see some of this when you go on the boards, like, you know, maybe it's not realistic to be insisting on AAU membership anymore. I don't know.
Well,
I mean,
Mike, you mentioned,
wasn't Nebraska admitted without AAU membership? I can't, maybe I'm wrong on that, but I was
they joined before they entered. I think that was a condition of their. But you know, you talked about Notre Dame. Notre Dame was never invited by the Big Ten. They were discussed by Big Ten athletic directors, but they were never invited by the Big Ten, you know, officially, because the Big Ten, you know, from the administrator standpoint, Notre Dame is a, you know, a high level school, a prestigious school, et cetera. But think about the two things that they have going. One, they're not a research university, and that's essential in the Big Ten. But look at the other thing. I mean, it's not just that they have a religious affiliation. It's that it's, and I hate to say it like this, but it's a Catholic affiliation. Can you imagine some of the Big Ten leaders and especially some of the Big Ten professors wanting a school or in the conference that all but says abortion, you know, speaks out against abortion? Can you imagine that? I mean, can you imagine the average Big Ten professor going to a cocktail party with a Notre Dame professor and getting into that discussion?
Yeah,
I mean, seriously,
with Father O'Malley or something. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I, you know, do the Big Ten humanities professors have you know, places like Iowa or Michigan or something have that much sway in what the Big Ten Sports Administration does. I mean, I know they're probably pretty woke. You know, we saw some of that with the current commissioner, but, you know, I don't know. I think that if they can get Notre Dame, I just, you know, I mean, I don't think they can for other reasons, but
yeah.
But I think if the Big Ten thought that Notre Dame was, you know, was calling on them, they'd probably have to take them.
I think they'd find a way. I mean, you know, it's funny though. Here's the thing about Notre Dame. They enjoy, you know, they're an ACC member. Last year they took an ACC bowl slot. They're an ACC member for basketball. They're a Big Ten member for hockey, which I thought when I heard that I was just floored. They are an actual Big Ten member for hockey, and I think for something else. They may not track, I don't think, but for something else, they might, you know. And to me, maybe lacrosse or something, one of those preppy sports. But, you know, that seems to me that people are letting them, you know, just have their cake, so to speak. And, man,
right.
I mean, how
so
do
that's
they?
That's it. Why are they letting them do that? Because especially if we go to a 12-team playoff, this preferential treatment that Notre Dame's been given for the 4-team playoff, and their ability to sort of be a quasi-member of the ACC while staying an independent. You know, if you would shut that off, then Notre Dame would have to make a decision on a conference, I think. I don't know why the rest of the NCAA schools don't do that.
Yeah. Well, BYU's independent. You know, they went independent. I think UConn went independent for football. Although they are, you know, a little bit, you know, down the totem pole, so to speak. I mean, they might not even be a division. I think they might be FCS for football now. But, you know, that's just
you, can,
you know, what
yeah.
do you think's gonna what do you think's gonna happen to the bowls with the 12-team playoff?
I think bowls are a lot of the bowls are in some trouble already. And the COVID stuff didn't help, you know, when half of them weren't able to go forward, like the one Iowa was supposed to play. I don't know. I'd be interested in what Indy Hawk thinks, but if you go to 12 teams, I mean, you're getting further and further away from the bowl system, it seems to me.
Yeah, I agree completely. The bowls have been diluted pretty severely, and the more the playoff comes in, the more you expand it, the more, you know, it de-emphasizes those bowls, but.
I mean, what bowls could theoretically benefit from the 12 team? I think the Citrus, probably. You know, what are the New Year's Six? It's what's the Cotton, the Peach, then the Rose, the Fiesta, the Sugar, and the Orange, right? Am I missing one?
Right.
Cotton, Peach.
Right.
Rose,
you know, why,
Fiesta,
you can make an
Orange,
argument,
and Sugar.
You know, you can make an argument for that. You could have six bowls, and that's where the actually, I think if they do a 12-team playoff, what you'd have four teams get a bye, and then you'd have the first eight play.
Right.
But anyway, you could have a certain number of bowls that were the venues for the playoff. But after that, you know, you got a 12-team playoff situation. Do you really need other bowls? I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe they'll stick around, but I think there'd be a lot fewer of them.
Yeah, hopefully it would get rid of some of the stuff that – you know, the Japan Bowl, the Bahamas Bowl, and all that. So I know those are rewards for, especially for lesser conference teams. And maybe that's the other thing they need to do is that, look, we have our 12-team playoff, and maybe, you know, maybe we have a total of 24 teams that then, you know, 12 more teams that get bowls. The rest of the bowls are left for the, you know, for the group of five or whatever, you know, because, I mean, you know, Do we really care when a 6-6 or a 7-5 Iowa team gets a bowl anymore? I mean, as Iowa fans, we don't. I mean, I think it's pretty, you know, yeah, we'll turn it on, but I mean, I don't get excited. I mean, I got to admit, I didn't get excited about the Insight Bowl that much, you know? I mean, it's just
right,
and
right.
the Pinstripe Bowl. Good Lord.
It seems like we've been saying that for a while now.
Yeah, and if you go to 12-team playoff, are they going to have to curtail the length of the regular season? I mean, how many games, you know, if you play 12 games and then you have a 12-team playoff, we're going to be playing almost as many games as an NFL team. Can they do that at the college level? Or do they have to scale back a game or two in regular season?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
you know, that's something they're going to have to look at, I think. You know, unless they want to have a 15 or 16 game season for 12 teams.
Well, Vito just pointed out, though, I picked on the Catholics and I picked on the Yankees, and then I also messed with community economics for those areas that talk about the bowl revenue. I would submit that a lot of those places don't get much bowl revenue. I know Orlando and Tampa, Jacksonville to a lesser degree have always said how much of a great impact their bowls are. I can't, you know. What's we missed out on the Music City? I can't imagine Nashville really needs the Music City Bowl, you know, given that it's the, you know, Music City,
so why
USA.
Why aren't the number of bowls contracting? Is it TV or it just seems they keep getting more and more? It seems like we've been saying this for quite a while. There's too many bowls. There's too many bowls, and you have to have a winning record.
Well, we've had recent years where that wasn't even required when there weren't enough
like
winning
a
5-7 teams.
5-7 Nebraska team was in a bowl or something.
Yeah,
like
so that's kind of, you know, what's gonna happen? I mean, that's kind of a good question. Here's something else I wanted to ask you guys about, because this is something that I think really it's not really talked about. It's getting to that point. You've seen this kid from Ohio State. You read about this kid, Quinn Ewers?
I have not.
Okay.
No, I haven't.
Quinn Ewers, he's a high school player in South Lake, Texas, South Lake Carroll. He has opted to reclassify from a 2022 recruit to a 2021 recruit this year because of, get this, NIL.
Wow.
He was offered an NIL deal. And it wasn't a sleazy merchandising deal. It was to be help be a spokesperson for a nonprofit that talks about teen suicide. And they thought he would be a good representative. And Texas doesn't allow it, believe it or not. Texas does not allow high schoolers to do that. And so he's reclassified. He was the number one quarterback recruit in the 2022 class and the number two overall. But now he is finishing high school. He is enrolling at Ohio State in the fall, which to me is bizarre. I mean, we've seen guys recently. Remember last year, a couple of guys sat out their senior year of high school for COVID or prepare for their college career. But this kid, he was originally a Texas recruit, by the way. He decommitted last October. But now, here's the thing. He's joining – Ohio State's got three quarterbacks, main quarterbacks. The current one that's expected to start was the number 104-ranked recruit in 2020. The number two guy is the number 284 recruit. And then the third is the number 31-ranked for this year, for 2021. So now you get the 2022 number one coming in. What do you think that does to their quarterback room?
You know, Ohio State's one team who I don't worry too much about as far as their recruiting goes, sort of like with Alabama, but, you know, we'll have to see how this pans out, too.
I was just looking, Iowa had a basketball player reclassify. Well, that just means they move up a year, right?
Yeah, that means they finish high school early and they move up, yeah.
When the revolving door started for the Iowa basketball program, says, well, maybe I'll sign up for next year.
Yep. Yeah, the revolving door. Well, who did we really lose? We lost Wieskamp early, and we lost Glassfoot, as I call him.
The two guys that were going to be the go-to guys both left. Nungy and Frederick.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot
that you did. No one saw that, and that can't be good for. I mean, of course, I didn't think that. Of course, you guys won't think it's an advantage. I didn't think Bohannon was going to come back. So, and I don't know, you know, how much of an impact that'll have, but I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, I just think, you know, this kid leaving high school early, but he says it was because of. I mean, I get it. In the sense that, you know, I don't know, how does it, I mean, if you're the number, let's say you're the number one or the number 31 ranked recruit in this year's class, you're figuring to be one of Ohio State's next quarterbacks, and then this kid who's a year behind you comes in. Of course, you already had that risk, I guess. So that doesn't, you know, that risk is always there that they're going to recruit over you or some guy's going to beat you out. So, but it just seems to me it's, you know, we're seeing all this stuff lately, and it's like, what, you know, what's going on? I mean, I'm really, though, here's the thing. The Big 12, that's the other thing. It's going to hurt recruiting. I mean, somebody, what did I hear the other day? Big 12 is estimating that they will experience at least a 50% drop in conference revenue. You know, I mean.
You mean from Oklahoma and Texas leaving? You mean?
Yeah, from Oklahoma and Texas leaving.
Well, I mean, that tells you that, I mean, Oklahoma and Texas, you're tearing the guts out of the Big 12, you know, financially, competitively, market wise. I mean, it's, you know, that it's just a fact, you know. So it's not, so like I say, you get these few other teams you could bring in, and the conference will not be, I don't think it qualifies as a Power Five anymore. It'll just have to accept its status as a lesser conference, which means lesser revenue.
But as you said, the Power Five, is that really even official? I mean, I guess it sort of is because of the way that the College Football Playoff Committee has worked. But I think that, and that's the other thing,
right.
The College Football Playoff Committee, does that, you know, is that part of what the constitutional convention is for the NCAA? Is does the SEC make a move on that? You know, think about that. I mean,
well, what do you mean by make a move on it?
Well,
I mean,
does the SEC want more control of the whole process?
Well, I think the SEC wants control. I mean, like I said, they're the Soviet Union of college football, right? They want everything. They're on the march. Mm-hmm. They're the stormtroopers moving on Poland, you know, with Poland being college football. It's just kind of, I mean, that's they are the aggressors in everything. But and they can't be allowed, I think, to just dominate college football. And that might be where the Big Ten at some point has to come in, because you cannot. I think the SEC could do it. They'd have 60 teams or something like that. Just suck everybody up they could imagine, and then they would just, you know, they really would replace the NCAA, and they'd have all the college football that matters.
Yeah, but I mean, what is that? Who wants to be part of that? You know, you think about it. Who really? I mean, if
right.
you're, I am shocked to hear that the 14 existing SEC members voted unanimously to accept Oklahoma and Texas.
Yeah, that surprises me too. And you know, I see what Indy Hawk thinks. We have schools like Arkansas and South Carolina. How do they benefit? You know, Mississippi State, Tennessee. How do they really benefit by you know, you making things bigger and more competitive? They're already struggling in terms of their competition level, but I guess, you know, if money's the bottom line, you can be mediocre and still rake in all of this money because you're in the SEC. So I don't, you know, it's kind of, I don't know how it plays out.
I just Googled the top five or the top grossing football programs in the country, and Texas is number one by far. 156 million, Georgia, 120 million next closest, Georgia, Michigan, Notre Dame, Ohio State, all the usual suspects. But I guess that's why Texas, it does make you wonder, how can they not dominate?
Well, it also makes you wonder, I mean, we say, why would you want to be part of it? But that's probably why ESPN's driving it, you know, and that's why I don't, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sorry, you're never going to convince me that ESPN's not the driving or one of the driving forces behind this. I mean, it just, you know, I just can't see how they wouldn't be, you know, and that's how, I mean, you know, if you're on the outside, you know, and that's the question though, is the SEC going to start kicking schools to the curb? Now, you know, does that happen?
Yeah.
I mean, now that you got Texas and Oklahoma, why do you need Arkansas? Why do you need Missouri? Now, South Carolina, I get, but why do you need Arkansas and Missouri?
it depends on what the SEC wants to do, though. If they want to just kind of gain more power and control of everything, they aren't going to be kicking anybody out. If you know, what you're suggesting is that they want to become a better conference but not be any larger, so you get somebody like Oklahoma and Texas in, and then why not discard, you know, Missouri and Arkansas or something like that? Well,
it's like the Rutgers question with the Big Ten. Did the Big Ten, was that a good move to bring Rutgers in? It depends if you're talking about, you know, competition-wise, no, but television sets, I don't know if I've seen any numbers, but it got them in New York City.
Yeah, exactly. It did get them the New York market. I mean, and you just can't pass that up.
Yep.
It'd be interesting to see what the revenue is, you know, the terms of the answer to that. If the revenues bear out that was a good move by the Big Ten or not. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I'd like to see that.
Although I will say this, they're predicting Rutgers with that Schiano now, but it's going to really be improved this
they're
year.
They're tearing it up recruiting-wise.
Right, right.
And we saw last year they have a good basketball team. You know, they have they have the tools. There's no doubt about it, and certainly that market for, especially for basketball. You know, that's pretty hard to argue against that.
You're getting some money to upgrade facilities. You can do a lot of things. So I look for them to take a next step.
Yep, and Schiano already proved he could do it when he was at Rutgers before. So, you know, when they were in the Big East, admittedly, but still they were tough in the Big East, and so while he was there. So, yeah, let's put it this way. What it does when you get a guy like that, it certainly doesn't hurt the conference, but what it does do is teams like Minnesota and Iowa who were in on a, you know, Amir Smith Marset, that slows down, you know, any momentum we had in New Jersey with him or Wadley or any of those guys, that diminishes with a Greg Schiano at Rutgers, you know, so that's going to affect it. And it makes you question, you know, does Alabama have a bigger foothold in Texas now, so to speak, because the Texas is in the SEC? I mean, that's the other question. Is Texas going to be able to lock down their recruiting? I mean, they haven't recently. They have not been able to do that. So I can't imagine why they'd be able to do that with SEC schools, you know, coming in and invading. So,
yep.
So
good question.
Anyway, so we'll see. Well, guys, hey, I'm gonna cut you out here. I want to finish with some Olympic report, but I really appreciate you guys being on. We'll continue to talk via text because this is not the end of all this. I have a feeling, you know, I don't see a move into the ACC because of what I heard Mark Packer say, but I don't really expect a move into the Big Ten, but you never know. I mean, maybe that's, you know, how they do it is push for an AAC Big 12 merger or something like that that would, you know, not leave all those Big 12 schools out and would strengthen the AAC's position a little bit, you know, and then ESPN and SEC can pretend to feel guilty or feel good about themselves or whatever it is. So, but thanks for being on, guys. We'll talk later, and I'll just mute you. I'll keep you on, but I'll mute you out. So, and we'll talk later on. So thanks for being here, Indy Hawk KB and Hawkeye Mike, with their thoughts on what is happening in this whole crazy mess. It really is. Vito asked a question. What happens when Saban retires at Alabama? He also points out that Greg Schiano at Rutgers is Italian. Vito, come on, man. Let's not make it so racist. He asks, is the addition of Texas and Oklahoma in anticipation of Alabama collapsing after Saban retires? That's not a bad question, actually. It's a very legit question because, you know, before Saban got there, Alabama had some good years on and off, but basically between Bear Bryant and Saban, there was Gene Stallings for a year or two, but that's it. So, hey, I want to close with the Olympics. Simone Biles ended up competing in one individual event, the balance beam. She won a bronze medal. Before everyone goes off on her, she's happy with it. So we should be too. What she experienced the last few weeks isn't just a golfer with the yips or a baseball player with the grips. It isn't a basketball player who's lost his touch, or even a high diver with vertigo, although that last one probably comes closest. I will briefly talk about it later, because I think people really need to lay off of her right now and just congratulate the other U.S. gymnasts that did well. In Olympic weightlifting, New Zealand transgender athlete Laurel Hubbard failed to achieve a lift in her competition. Unfortunately, this will wake up exactly zero people in the IOC or any of weightlifting's governing bodies, because they've already – that cat's out of that bag. U.S. women's hammer thrower Gwen Berry did make the Olympic final. She bloviated on about how she was going to protest, and she promptly finished 11th place out of the 12 competitors in the final. Way to go, Gwen Berry. Way to represent. Women's shot put silver medalist Raven Saunders. Remember, she's the one who made an X with her arms on the podium. She is temporarily not under investigation by the Olympic Committee due to the passing of her mother, Clarissa. Her mother was interviewed last week on TV, or a week or so, maybe a little longer. Talk about excited to see her daughter compete, even if it was only on TV. So sad loss for her. Condolences to Raven Saunders, protest or not. American discus thrower Valerie Allman, she won the gold in the women's discus throw. While that is enough of an accomplishment in and of itself, achievement, because you look at the U.S.'s history, it's not great in the weights. You look at her, she's a former dancer. You would doubt that she is, you know, nobody's going to predict that she wins. She's not all bulked up, which kind of proves that it isn't just size or strength in an event like that, but technique. So kudos to her. Another surprise came in the women's 3,000 steeplechase. American Courtney Ferrix won silver, broke away from the pack with about two laps to go, and almost pulled it out. Americans have never really fared well in that event, on either men's or women's. Now, one who did in 2016, Emma Coburn, was the bronze medalist. She actually got disqualified in this year's event. So the U.S. women's soccer team, after going loss, win, and tie, lost in a shootout to Canada, thus being eliminated from gold medal contention and, by extension, gold, silver medal contention. They take on Australia on August 5th. But since it's in Tokyo, that could mean it happened this morning. I'm all messed up on their time. Veto. It's a tough hurdle. Anyway, as the proud owner of a beautiful miniature Australian Shepherd, all I can say is Aussies rule. In other words, I don't care if the women's team loses. On the track, let's face it, this is where the real Olympics happens for many of us. We've seen some amazing performances. We saw an American-born Italian, there you go, Vito, take the men's 100-meter. The world record in the pole vault, world record holder, did not set a record, but he did defeat the American record holder. We saw a silver medal in the women's 100-meter hurdles, silver medal in the women's long jump. More surprisingly, we saw a silver in the women's shot put, as I mentioned, and a gold in the women's discus. American men have not fared very well in the jump events. We got a silver in the 100, although Trevon Bromell flamed out. We saw gold and silver in the women's 400 hurdles, both Americans, by the way, breaking the world record set by Sydney McLaughlin at the trials last month. And then in the men's side, man, Norwegian Karsten Warholm and American Rye Benjamin, they both, man, just absolutely obliterated Warholm's world record that he set last month. Coming in, the world record was 46.78. Now, when Kevin Young ran that in 1992, they thought it was kind of crazy because he beat Edwin Moses' old record by 0.24. Warholm went 46.70 last month. He went 45.94. And then Rye Benjamin ran 46.13. Amazing. That's almost 30 years. On the women's side, both McLaughlin and silver medalist Delilah Muhammad ran faster than all but 18 of the women's 400 flat. In other words, not the hurdles, just the 400 times for the heats. Like I said, both the men's and women's 400-meter races, meter hurdle races were amazing, easily the two best races of the Olympics. Shoe design has been improved. The track has been improved, according to both Benjamin and Warholm. They said it's conducive to fast times. We aren't seeing any of Usain Bolt's records being threatened. the 200 today. We did see Canadian Andre DeGrasse run 19.62. And then American Kenny Bednarik and Noah Lyles got silver and bronze. Bednarik actually won. He ran 19.68. Lyles ran the same time that he ran at the trials, so he no improvement there. Same as in the 100, Trayvon Bromell didn't improve at all. In fact, he went backward. The women's 800 saw an American record. Ating Mo, 155.21 for the gold. American Raven Rogers got bronze. No veto. He did not take Bolt's 100-meter record. Raven Rogers got bronze in 156.81. I've got to believe that this is the first time we've seen two American women go sub-157 in international competition. Men's 800, no Americans medaled, painfully slow. It was 145.06. Now, to give you an idea, the world record is 140.92. 145.86 was the winning time for the last American to win the gold in the 800. That was Dave Waddell in 1972. So, yeah, the Olympics, depending on how you look at them, the track events have been interesting but have not been lighted up, you know, all the way across, except for a couple events. So let's finish it up. Okay, you know what? Let's just go right to here's a creepy Central Florida story. This is an Epic Times story, very creepy. 17 people were arrested in an undercover sex sting operation. No, not prostitution arrests, but the kind you see on Dateline Catch a Predator. Remember where that creep Chris Hansen would come out from behind a door and confront the sleazebags? Anyway, they thought they were showing up to have sex with a minor. Three of them were employees with Walt Disney World. One was a lifeguard at Disney's Wilderness Lodge pools. Another one gave details of role-playing games he and his 13-year-old could play. To top it off, though, another one person showed up, no condoms. And here's the creepy part. Several others did bring them. But this creep, one creep, showed up, no condoms. He tested HIV positive. Yeah, people, there are still scumbags out there, whether COVID's happening or whatever. Ugh. Here's another one from the Western Journal. Dopey Joe, day after saying he didn't have the authority to do it, he is now issuing a new eviction moratorium. Supposedly, it will be limited only to counties that the CDC deems as... Meanwhile, though, they're living, buying, selling, renting, or managing properties are going to get the screws put to them yet again. And here is what Dopey Joe said. I have been informed the CDC is about to make a judgment as to potential other options. Whether that option will pass constitutional measure with this administration, I can't tell you. I don't know. The bulk of the constitutional scholarship says that it's not likely to pass constitutional muster. And then Dopey Joe closed with this. But there are key scholars who think that it may, and it's worth the effort. Huh? He doesn't know? What does he think? I'll answer that, by the way. He doesn't because he can't. I'm not laughing at him, you understand. This is not funny. What I am is I'm frantic over the fact that this guy continues to sit as the Don of La Dopey Nostra. Doesn't have the capacity or capability to serve as a capo or even an associate, let alone the actual boss. I mean, he's not even good as a front boss with the big tuna, Anthony Accardo Obama, as the real boss. That's what happened, by the way, folks. This is just, it's another version of a land grab, a seizure, a wealth confiscation, if you will. Commercial property owners are going to get killed the next decade anyway, as many companies aren't bringing employees back. They're utilizing them remotely more. For residential property owners, whether it be individuals, trusts, conglomerates, consortiums, I don't care what you call it, how their ownership structure is termed, they're going to get destroyed. The only way they can make this fly, as I see it, is with more PPP money or other relief. And guess what? The only way that happens is with a severe and serious increase in the national debt ceiling. guess who would buy as much of that debt as they can? I'll give you a hint. They won't be U.S. investors. Yeah, I think Obama just stepped in and told him, no, we're going to do it. On top of all that, Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen is using, quote, extraordinary measures, unquote, unless and until the debt ceiling is raised, in order to give the federal government, quote, more room to spend the imposed debt cap. Remember, the two-year moratorium on the nation's debt ceiling has been reinstated at $28.5 billion. Now, coupled with the U.S. Treasury's cash balance of roughly $450 billion, $50 billion versus $28.5 billion for the debt ceiling, $28.5 trillion for the debt ceiling, Treasury will suspend certain investments in pension and health care funds for government employees that are not immediately necessary. Unless and until the debt ceiling is raised, the government is not able to sell securities to raise cash. And with the approximate $300 billion versus trillion temporary savings along with the Treasury's cash balance, Yellen told congressional types that the U.S. should be able to last until October or November without defaulting on any debt. Let's hope for two things. First of all, it would require support from about 10 GOP senators. Let's hope for two things. One, a temporary increase, if there is one, with a timetable for reducing the debt. And two, let's hope the GOP or any other sane congressional types use that as a hard negotiating tool. Here's an interesting one. The FDA has authorized an antibody cocktail to prevent infection in some who are exposed to COVID. This would be a preventive measure, not a prophylaxis. The idea is that it would prevent progression of the disease in high-risk individuals who have had exposure. The FDA stressed that it should only be used as a post-exposure measure for those not fully vaccinated or whose immune systems are compromised. You know, between stories like this and Fauci's multiplicity, the skewed reporting, the statistics, the lies, I don't even know where to go with all that stuff, except this. Keep on living, folks. If you want to get vaxxed, or do so. If you don't, same thing. Take precautions, of course. If you do get sick, don't brush it off. Take some action. Try to get better, et cetera. Meanwhile, the WHO is calling for a moratorium on vax booster shots, vaccine boosters that are coming out, until more of the world at large is vaxxed. Seriously. Look, I get we all want the world to be protected. But at this point, the U.S. needs to tell the WHO to pound sand and let them and China or whoever take care of that. Because we need to take care of us and ours. Until we do that, we shouldn't be offering free housing and health care to illegal immigrants or giving away vaccines to countries who hate us or merely leech off us. Finally, this from the political world. A top Arizona senator is asking the state attorney general to probe Maricopa County's refusal to abide by subpoenas deemed lawful and valid by a judge. Majority Whip Sonny Borelli has asked Attorney General Mark Brnovich to investigate Maricopa County's Board of Supervisors as to why they have refused to comply thus far. The supervisors claim the subpoenas are an overreach. Yeah, this despite the state law that not only allows it, but requires it. Still, Maricopa County has refused to provide routers as well as router images, claiming a security risk. Yeah, their security. Seriously, what do they expect us to believe? I mean, how hard is it to provide something with the understanding that certain protocols could be observed? Security protocols, seriously. Here's why. They know the risk of the truth becoming public. Otherwise, they'd have been fully on board. In fact, revealing an actual La Dopi Nostra victory would have been paramount for them. And amazingly, Big Left was nothing like this in 2000 or 2004 or 2016, but now suddenly, no. Okay, and I'm going to close with this, as I said. Let's lay off Simone Biles. I'm pretty sure she didn't plan on getting the twisties, that's what gymnasts call it, before she went to Tokyo. She attributed it to stress and pressure. She said that she's actually had them before, earlier in her career. But there's a big difference between trying to soldier on and getting, like, maimed. In gymnastics, the best she could expect is a rubber mat, which will not protect her from a broken neck or a broken back. And let me put it another way. If you're hopping a cross-country flight and you hear the pilots yakking on about vertigo, I hope you're like me and you'd get the hell off the flight. You'd have the good sense to do that. Well, that's essentially what she has, but with no protection. They get into the twist, and she said even watching others that she just got disoriented. So in this case, we'd have been asking her to sacrifice safety and health for a little bit of national pride. And as was said in the movie Chariots of Fire, a guilty national pride is a damn steep price to pay for an individual sacrifice. That she managed to do a severely limited, by her standards, routine on the balance beam and win a bronze medal should be good enough. It's good enough for her, and it should be good enough for us. You can't believe this is how she wanted her Olympics to go. But she salvaged a bronze medal. So, hey, deal with it, accept it, wish her well whatever she does and wherever it takes her. I'm going to close with some social stuff, social memes. A good Facebook meme with pictures of the squad and then like Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders et al. And it's a Tucker Carlson quote on top. It says, "No country can survive being ruled by people who hate it." Another one is Will Ferrell is his anchorman role. In the top says, 34 people died in Chicago this week from COVID gunshot wounds. And underneath it says, they will be voting by mail. That's a good one. Not funny, but good. On Twitter, this is going to shock you, Meghan McCain has become a voice of reason again, or quasi-reason. Really scary lately, but she has. She tweeted out this pretty insightful piece. She said, "So we're all going to be hospitalized and children are going to die of COVID, but a giant Lollapalooza concert with thousands of people with no masks in sight is going on in Chicago. And Mayor Muriel Bowser can have a maskless indoor birthday party and attend a large maskless wedding indoors." And then she also did this retweet from a guy named Robbie Swabie. "There were three times as many murders as there were COVID deaths in Washington, D.C. during the month of July." Another one. This is a Facebook meme featuring Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson of North Carolina. It's his picture, and it says this little gem: "If dead people and illegals were voting for Republicans, Dems would not only want voter IDs, they would also want fingerprints, an eye scan, and a DNA sample." He ain't wrong, folks. Just saying, he ain't wrong. Okay, before I head out of here, remember, COVID is real. Suicide's real, too. So is abortion. So are shuttered businesses. All that's real. So when you sit there and hear COVID is real, I agree, it's real. One of the people I talk to regularly, good friend, is recovering. So it's real. So it's all that other stuff. And lest anyone tell you differently, college football is more real than all of those. So there you go. Just ask me. In my world, college football is more real than any of those. Not the only thing, but it's a pretty good thing. So anyway, hey, we've come to the end of it. Me and Mrs. Jones are going to go out and do some exercise and walking to get into top shape for our daughter's wedding. Y'all be safe. Enjoy the rest of the Olympics. The closing ceremonies happen this weekend, I think. Isn't that that whole thing with him being in – it either happens yesterday or tomorrow, whatever, however that goes. Other stuff going on, you know, we're getting in – like I said, we're getting back to college football. Oh, real quick, pro football started some of their practices. A guy yesterday got cut, waived by a team for, quote-unquote, a bad hit on a teammate, defensive back hitting a wide receiver. He got cut right away. I think, you know, that's the other kind of stuff we're seeing. Look, nobody goes out there to hurt people. This isn't the days of Jack Tatum. It was a mistimed hit. He hit the guy went down, but they cut him. Come on, man. He was a free agent anyway. He was undrafted free agent, signing a free agent contract. I just think that's poor. So anyway, hey, have a good week. Be safe. Have fun. Or as they say in Spinal Tap, have a good time all the time. And go Hawkeyes. And it's, like I said, it's 4 weeks until I head to Seattle and 30 days until my daughter and my wife's daughter, actually our daughter, gets married. So, hey, have a good one. I'm going to send you off with some, Jeff Beck. Y'all have a good one, folks. Of course, as he leaves and as they both hang up, I completely forgot to thank Hawkeye Mike and Indie Hawk KB for being here. Guys, biggest thanks. You guys always contribute great stuff, so I really appreciate it. And folks, like I said, have a great one, and thanks for those that were on. Really appreciate it. I was going to say back to Jeff Beck, but come on, we'll let it go. Folks, have a good one. Good night.